We're going to read Exodus 5, starting in verse 1, and we're going to go through chapter 6, verse 1. It may seem like an abrupt place to stop. I'm doing that for two reasons. One, there's actually a break in the text there, so that's a good reason to do it. But also because it's going to, I think, help us as we continue marching through the life of Moses. But let me read this to you, Exodus chapter 5, starting in verse 1. Afterward, Moses and Aaron went and said to Pharaoh, "Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, let my people go that they may hold a feast to me in the wilderness." But Pharaoh said, "Who's the Lord? Who's the Lord that I should obey his voice and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, and moreover, I will not let Israel go." Then they said, "The God of the Hebrews has met with us. Please let us go 3 days' journey into the wilderness that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God, lest he fall upon us with pestilence or with the sword." But the king of Egypt said to them, "Moses and Aaron, why do you take the people away from their work? Get back to your burdens." And Pharaoh said, "Behold, the people of the land are now many. You make them rest from their burdens." The same day, Pharaoh commanded the taskmasters of the people and their foremen, "You shall no longer give the people straw to make bricks as in the past. Let them go and gather straw for themselves. But the number of bricks that they made in the past you shall impose on them, and you shall by no means reduce it, for they're idle. Therefore they cry, 'Let us go and offer sacrifice to our God.' Let heavier work be laid on the men, that they may labor at it and pay no regard to lying words." So the taskmasters and the foremen of the people went out and said to the people, "Thus says Pharaoh, I will not give you straw. Go and get your straw yourselves, wherever you can find it, but your work will not be reduced in the least." So the people were scattered throughout all the land of Egypt to gather stubble for straw. The taskmasters were urgent, saying, "Complete your work. Your daily task each day is when there was straw." And the foremen of the people of Israel, whom Pharaoh's taskmasters had set over them, were beaten and were asked, "Why have you not done all your task of making bricks today and yesterday, as in the past?" Then the foremen of the people of Israel came and cried to Pharaoh, "Why do you treat your servants like this? No straw is given to your servants, yet they say to us, 'Make bricks.' And behold, your servants are beaten, but the fault is in your own people." But he said, "You're idle. You're idle. That's why you say, 'Let us go and sacrifice to the Lord.' Go now and work. No straw will be given you, but you must still deliver the same number of bricks." The foremen of the people of Israel saw that they were in trouble when they said, "You shall by no means reduce your number of bricks, your daily task each day." They met Moses and Aaron, who were waiting for them, and they came out from Pharaoh, and they said to them, "The Lord look on you and judge, because you've made us stink in the sight of Pharaoh and his servants, and have put a sword in their hand to kill us." Then Moses turned to the Lord and said, "O Lord, why have you done evil to this people? Why did you ever send me? For since I came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he's done evil to this people, and you've not delivered your people at all." But the Lord said to Moses, "Now you shall see what I will do to Pharaoh. For with a strong hand, he will send them out. And with a strong hand, he will drive them out of his land." This is the word of the Lord. I was hoping you'd say it. Many years ago, a friend and I, we decided that we would take this big bike ride. He lived in North Carolina at the time, so he lived kind of right at the foot, right by the Smoky Mountains. So we thought, hey, let's take a mountain bike ride, because, you know, at that time, it's not so much the case now. I've gotten old enough, and I've kind of seen my children, that I think that riding very swiftly down the side of a mountain is not as appealing as it used to be. But at this point, like, that was the big hope of the trip. Like, I'm going to make it up the mountain, really for the sole purpose of going down the mountain very fast. We went down the mountain pretty fast. At one point, I was like, looked over, and there's like a car driving next to me. So anyway, it was awesome. I might have died, but it was awesome. So anyway, but to have the exhilaration of the downhill, of course, you have to do what? You have to go up the mountain. And there were lots of times when, as we're climbing up this mountain on our bikes, and through the pain and fire raging in my legs, and through the profound depletion of oxygen in my lungs, I was thinking, okay, I can make this, because there's the top of there's the crest of the hill. If I can just get there, all will be well, I'll breathe again, someone will extinguish the fire in my quadriceps, and I can be happy, go down the hill. And we get to the crest, and you go, oh no, there's more. the disappointment is visceral at that point, right? Now, I think that Moses might have felt something like that in this moment. Because think about what's going on. Like, here he is meeting with Pharaoh. This is after all of his attempts to get out of his calling, to not go to Egypt at all, he ends up going. And after all of the excitement, by excitement I mean, of course, the strange emergency circumcision that happened that we preached about last week, he finally gets to Egypt. And when he gets to Egypt, he tells the people what's going to happen. And what do? They receive him. They welcome him. This is great. And they have this lovely worship service, and all is going well. So I picture Moses and Aaron getting together, and they're on their way for the big confrontation with Pharaoh. They go waltzing in there, and they tell Pharaoh, this is what the Lord said, and they're probably waiting for the big exit. But then Pharaoh says, No. I'm not letting your people go. Pharaoh's response was not compliance with the commands of Yahweh. And you notice just how obstinate Pharaoh is? I mean, Moses probably goes in there thinking, here we go. Well, he sent me and I did it, so the Lord's about to act. It's going to be amazing. And then, but just notice how obstinate Pharaoh is here. He doesn't just say no. I mean, we shouldn't read verse 2 as Pharaoh going, oh, wait, who is Yahweh? Because I guess I've never heard of this Yahweh before. Tell me about him. I don't understand. That's not what Pharaoh says. Instead, Pharaoh here is just with utter contempt, disregarding who he sees as this two-bit deity that let his people be enslaved for 400 years. It's Pharaoh saying, Yahweh? Who's Yahweh? I'm Pharaoh. Who is this Yahweh? Give me a break. I'll decide when these people leave, not whoever you think this Yahweh is. This is not Pharaoh going, oh, I'd like to know more. This is Pharaoh acting with utter contempt. You see, Moses goes in expecting one thing, but he sees that the hill he's been climbing is not yet done. And in fact, when we get here, this text really sets up what is kind of like the battle royal between the king of Egypt, who sees himself as a god, Pharaoh, versus, I guess it's like the fight card. There's Pharaoh on one side. And it sounds like a Carmen video. Anyway, if you don't know who Carmen is, that's okay. Some of you are like, oh, well, we know Carmen. Okay. Think like early 90s, Christianese. It's bad. Anyhow, so this is the fight card. You've got like Pharaoh on one side who believes that he's a god, and he's been controlling this large group of people for over 400 years, or his people have been. And on the other side of the fight card is this god, the God of the Jews, who proclaims in places like Isaiah 45 that there are no rivals to him. This is the big battle being set up. Now, Moses thought he was coming to the crest of the hill. He was ready to go smiling down the other side. But instead, there's this battle about to happen. There's more hill to climb. Now, I would imagine that for some of you, you've had an experience something like that. Maybe not at the level of geopolitics, but maybe life has thrown some pretty steep inclines at you. And just about the time you think you're finally getting to the crest of the hill, you think you've nearly made it, and you get to the spot that you think is the end, and you find, like, wait, there's more? I have to climb more? Some of you, I would imagine, have dealt with some really hard seasons, only to find there are more hard days after that. Some of you have thought that that bad situation that you thought was finally coming in has another stinky bit to it on the other end. What looked like a chance for resolution has just ended in more conflict and more conflict. And you might even think about all that and go, okay, when is this whole salvation thing going to kick in? Because I'm not feeling very victorious in the moment. Some of you, I imagine, feel like that this morning. Well, I think our text this morning, believe it or not, helps us. It helps us in those times. The reality is that, just like Moses, we aren't at the end. Sometimes in our circumstances, sometimes in our challenges, we're not where we thought we would be. But we're also not left with nothing. When we get to chapter 6, verse 1, after this whole big episode that we're going to look at in a little more detail, at the end of all this, as Moses is frustrated, the Lord says, now you'll see what I'm going to do. Now, the reality is that even at that point, it's not over with. Moses still has to wait and watch. And I think that's what we want to really push in on in this text. When we get to this, in the middle of Moses' challenge, when he's not at the top of the hill like he thought, the Lord basically is telling him, I want you to watch and see what I do now. The Lord is going to win this battle. The Lord will be the victor. But for right now, you're going to have to watch. And we need to parse that out a little bit. So let's pursue for a few minutes then. What does it mean for us to watch in those times when we think the battle is going to be over? We think the hard season is going to be done, but it's not. How do we watch? Well, the first thing I want us to see about that kind of watching is that we need to watch with some humility. When Moses and Aaron went in to speak, they went in, we want to be careful not to read too much into the text, but I think that there's evidence in the text that they went in maybe with a little bit of bluster. They went in maybe with their chin up and their shoulders back because, hey, it's time for this big saving act. The first words that they use, they go in, and Aaron, probably through Moses, they go in and they say, Yahweh, the God of Israel, says. Now, they used in that sentence both the name of the Lord, this covenant name of God, Yahweh, or however it would have been pronounced, and they also use the God of Israel. This is Israel is a term that they might have called themselves. It's their big family name. And then Pharaoh pops their balloon. And do you notice how they speak next? Things sort of get scaled back a little bit. The reference is to their God in a more general way. And then they begin to use the term, the God of the Hebrews. The Hebrew, that's the term that other people would have used of them. And it wasn't even always nice. Things are getting scaled back a bit. And then there's this bit of desperation where he says, well, lest he fall upon us with pestilence or with the sword. See, in their bluster, they're getting knocked off course a little bit. And in the end, I think they're misrepresenting God. Did God say he was going to kill them if they didn't do what he said? Was the Lord going to bring pestilence to God's people? Now, this is not an isolated event. There have been lots of times that God's people have put their chin up and their shoulders back and they've pranced in and made pronouncements, sometimes hubristic statements about how the world works, only to sheepishly have to retreat a little bit afterwards going, oh, I guess we didn't get that one quite right. This is not the first time it's happened. Sometimes God's people have spoken with a great deal of hubris and then found themselves surprised by the lack of compliance that the rest of the world gives. That kind of compliance that we might have thought we were entitled to. I mean, hey, yeah, man, we're God's people. Aren't you supposed to do this? Sometimes the sudden awareness of our missteps, sometimes when we've misrepresented God, in fact, in our arrogance, sometimes the awareness of that can be very frustrating. I remember back in, this is going to date me a little bit, I remember back in 1988 in my high school, this booklet, it was a Christian high school, this book circulated, I might have mentioned this once before, the booklet was entitled 88 Reasons Why the Rapture Will Be in 1988. It was a bold prediction that was followed up by another bold prediction entitled The Final Shout, Rapture Report 1989. Now that was followed by another bold projection announcement I can't find. I don't speak English in this moment, apparently. Another bold thing comes out, and then it says 23 reasons why a pre-tribulation rapture looks like it will occur on Rosh Hashanah 1993. And that was followed by another bold proclamation about what the Lord would do in 1994, entitled, And Now the Earth's Destruction by Fire, Nuclear Bomb Fire. All bold predictions. All wrong. Church history is stock full of similar proclamations. And we've already noted in this sermon series that, you know, sometimes we have to wait on what the Lord's doing. Sometimes we just have to wait. We've also noted that, you know what, sometimes the Lord lets things get worse before they get better. We've noted that already as well. There is a lot that we don't understand about the ways of God. We have good reason to believe that the Lord will act faithfully. But we don't have good reason to believe that we're always going to understand the timeline or the circumstances. So I believe that as we are waiting for the Lord to complete the things that he's promised, we need to have a measure of humility about it. To watch for the Lord's victory with humility. Now, that doesn't mean we can never have confidence in anything. It is a popular stance, I think, in the church these days to assume that like everything's just up for grabs and there's some sort of like virtue in doubt. I don't believe that for 1 minute. There's no virtue in doubt. But there's great virtue in humility. There are things that we don't understand about the ways of God, but there are some things that are clear. There are some things about the nature and character of God that we can be very confident in. Places we can put our feet down and say, I know that the Lord is like this. This is clear. There are some things that God has made clear to us. We can stand on those things with sure-footed faith, even though there are other things that are not so clear. So I'm not advocating doubt as a virtue. But I am saying to all of us that as we wait upon the Lord to do the things that he's promised to do, some humility is in order. As we wait for the Lord to right the wrongs of the world and fix the brokenness of the world and judge the injustice of the world, we need to exercise some restraint on how we go about proclaiming how the Lord's going to do stuff. So maybe that means we rethink that post we're about to stick on our Facebook page. Maybe we pump the brakes on the accusatory comments about the culture on one hand or about the church on the other hand. Some humility, I think. I believe what we need to do is be sure that we're not tying our faith to our ability to predict God's responses to the circumstances of life. Instead, we wait for the Lord's victory. We watch for the Lord's full victory. But we do that with humility. Well, there's a second way that I think the text shows us to watch for, to wait for God's victory. And that's that we need to watch with an honest hope. Let me explain what I mean. When we get to verse 22 here, Moses responds with utter frustration. Remember that in the text? When you get there and Moses begins to say things like, why have you done evil to this people? I mean, Moses is saying, what are you doing? You sent me here. You sent me here, Lord. And now look, it just looks like evil to me. And I'm going to tell you that I understand his frustration. By all appearances, this doesn't seem right. This is not the way it should have gone, it doesn't seem. It looks like a royal mess. I mean, Pharaoh is throwing his authority around in such a way to be sure this kind of request will never happen again. I mean, you kind of think, like, why Pharaoh could have just said, Moses, Aaron, you're out of here, you know, get rid of those guys, but he didn't. He did something that I think is just as, or maybe even more wicked and more vile. Pharaoh turned the people of Israel who had just bowed and worshiped for God's answer against the one who had brought them a message of victory. You think about what Pharaoh is doing here. He's acting with a smug kind of villainy, a stomach-turning smugness here, to be sure that this group of people do not ever do this again. It's a vile way for an authority to use their power. It's the kind of thing that many other wicked and controlling people might do to solidify their position of power and make sure that those people stay subjugated. It's smug and it's vile. And you may have had similar situations, though again, maybe not at the level of geopolitics or something like national slavery. You may have wrestled with an issue of sin in your life, and you read all the right books, and you met with all the right people, but it still keeps popping up in your life. You may have given your kid every advantage, only to find that they still are not cooperating. You may have acted with integrity, skill at work, only to find that you're still being unjustly overlooked. You may have done everything right, only to find, like, this is still not working. What is wrong here? Or maybe even, I mean, I said you might not have experienced something at a systemic level, but what about at a systemic level? Some of you, I think, are working really hard to lean against injustices of our age. What if you do that and then all of a sudden you realize that the dent that you make is really small? And what if you're leaning against some evil of our age and then you realize that that evil is still lurking in your own heart? Maybe this leads you, like Moses, to start casting accusations towards God. What is going on with this, God? Why is it like this? Where's the victory? Maybe that's you. There's a raw honesty to Moses in this passage. And I'm going to go ahead and tell you, from the mic and everything, I think he's right. I think that Moses' raw honesty in this moment is the right response. I believe that the Lord is okay with us asking these kind of questions when they're born out of honest wrestling with the things that God is doing, things that we don't understand. And in fact, if we look through the scriptures, the Psalms are chock full of these kind of cathartic questions for the Lord. And what about Job? If you're familiar with the book of Job, you might not have noticed, Job is not formally rebuked. His friends are, but not Job. Notice that, like the psalmists and like Job, in his frustration, you see what he's doing? He's honest in all the raw reality of his honesty, his not understanding. But what is Moses doing here? He's taking those questions to the Lord. He's taking his misunderstanding, his even at points accusations, but what is he doing with them? He's turning to the Lord and saying, I don't get what you're doing here. This doesn't seem right. It's the very thing we see throughout the scriptures. Moses was reeling about how Yahweh was going about things, but Moses was still talking, and Moses was still asking, and Moses was still looking. Moses is still hoping. I mean, Moses takes these things to the Lord because there's a sense in which, like, if something's going to happen, like, you've got to do something about this. Clearly, Moses is hopeless or helpless. As we wait upon the Lord to bring to fullness the kind of salvation victory that he's promised, the kinds of things we were singing about in the service, these big ticket scenes of hopefulness and restoration, as we wait on the Lord to bring that, we need to watch with an honest kind of a hope. And that means we continue to take our frustrations to the Lord. With whatever little tiny sliver of hope we can muster, to continue taking them to the Lord and saying, I still don't get this, but I'm still here before you. I'd suggest to you, in fact, that the problem is not in our being frustrated with the things that we don't understand. That's not the problem. In some sense, shouldn't we expect to not understand the ways of God? The problem is not in being frustrated with the things that we don't understand. I actually think that by not asking the questions, by not taking our questions, the questions we have about the ways of God, to him in prayer with questions, what we do is we allow our God-designed sense of justice to atrophy. We should be taking our questions about justice to the Lord. Not only are we allowing our God-designed sense of justice to atrophy, we're also short-circuiting, I think, the ways in which the Lord would expand our view of his saving acts. You see, sometimes we just think, oh, I don't get this, it's just not right, and we bail. And we fail to see the riches of just how deep the saving acts of God are going and will go. We think we have it all figured out, and when God's saving acts don't meet our criteria, we think, well, they're clearly not good enough. But the Lord is working something deeper than you can imagine. You don't understand. Listen, I don't understand. We don't understand the depths of the saving acts of Christ. We should expect to be frustrated when it's not going the way that we would envision it, because we wouldn't envision it the right way. Not being honest, though, about our questions, it shrinks our perspective of the victory of God. So again, the problem isn't in honestly asking God hard questions in the throes of our frustration. The problem is when we give up on even caring to ask. So while we wait on the Lord to bring his victory to fullness, we need to watch with honesty, but with an honest hope that knows that if I keep taking this back to him, he won't leave me. Will you take your honest thoughts and your honest questions to the Lord? When you study, probably talked about this in Sunday school kind of settings or something. When you study stories, many of you know these things, so let me just tell you something you know here. One of the frameworks for understanding how story works is a story arc. You guys have heard some of these things, right? Stories tend to start with some kind of exposition that, like, explains the setting, some of the characters involved, some of what's going on, introductory stuff. And then there's this what's called the rising action, and that's where the conflict happens, and the story heats up, and you figure out what's going on in the story and what's the problem that needs to be worked out. So then the tension builds in that rising action. At some point in the story, there's the climax. And that's the big event that begins to answer the conflict, and then that has to be worked out in what's called the resolution. Okay, there you go. There's literature 101, I suppose, or something like that. As we work through the life of Moses, we're going to continue to look through big items about God's saving acts through this lens of Moses, this character, right? But you need to know that there's always going to be a difference between the way that Moses is seen and understanding salvation in our text and the way that we can. You see, at every point in Moses' life, including here in our text, Moses is going to be in the rising action. By that I mean that all the stories we're going to look at, every single story that we're going to look at in the life of Moses, is always going to be in the rising action of the big story. When we get to the Exodus, it's actually not the climax. Because the Exodus is going to happen, and then there's going to be more conflict. They're going to get to Sinai, and we might think, oh, Sinai, the Lord's meeting with them to give them the law. And then we're going to go, oh, there's more conflict after that. Still in the rising action. And then they're going to get to the promised land. They're going to think, finally, the promised land. Oh, that didn't go that well. Oh, here comes a king. And another one. And another one. And another one. Then there's exile. Then there's return from exile. All these things, they're not the big climax. They're not the thing that changes the story, that turns the tension. They're all parts of the hill where you realize, oh boy, there's more. I say that, though, because we actually get to view salvation differently than Moses did. Because the great turning point of the story of all history happened when Jesus rose from the dead after he died on the cross. See, the thing is that all the action that we're looking at in the life of Moses, it's all in this rising action, the building tension, it's setting the stage until finally something's going to happen that's going to turn the whole tale. And we get to look back on Jesus having done that when he died on the cross and rose again. What that means is this. I mean, when Jesus rose from the dead, he had conquered the curse of death by the cross. And unlike Moses, because of what Jesus did, we live in the resolution of the story. Now, that doesn't mean that everything is put back together yet. You know that it's not. That doesn't mean that there won't be struggles in our lives. There will be. But the difficulty and the challenge that we see and the struggles of our lives, they're a part of the Lord's working out the resolution. It's the working out of the implications of this great climactic act of Christ's resurrection from the grave. One day, Jesus will return, and all the final bits of the story are going to be tied up and fully resolved. It's all going to be put together. We're going to finally understand how the story works out. And then the victory that Jesus won that we've been singing about when he burst from the grave will have reached its full implications, not just for me, not just for you, but for the entire cosmos. But right now, we're still in the resolution of the story. So while we wait, we watch. But we do that watching with a great deal of humility as we wait upon the resolution of the story. As we wait to see how the implications of the climax get worked out, we do that with humility. But even in the resolution, we watch and we wait with an honest hope. My prayer for us this morning is as we turn our attention to the Lord's table, that we'll continue to do just that. That we'll come to this Lord's table to remember what Jesus has done, to remember this big climactic act of history that's getting worked out. And we'll come here humbly and say, like, I don't earn a way to this table. I can't come barging in the table because somehow I can put my chin up and my shoulders back and say, I belong here. We need to come with some humility and say, I get to come here, but not because of me, but because Jesus has acted for me. We also come here with honesty. Some of you are going to come to the Lord's table this morning after trying to climb some hills and only realize that, oh, there's more. Some of you are coming here this week maybe even questioning if you even want to bother continuing to climb the hill. I want to encourage you to come to the Lord's table with that kind of honesty. Even to say to the Lord, in your partaking of the Lord's Supper, like, I don't think I have strength to keep this up. I'm not sure that this is right. But would you also come to the Lord's table with an honest hope that says, I don't get it. I'm frustrated. But I'm still here. I'm still coming. As we wait upon the Lord to work out the resolution of this great story that he's enacted, would you come to the Lord's table? Would you come with humility? Would you come with an honest hope? Let's go to the Lord's table now.